Now you also got to remember that nation states are a product of a historic time frame. That historic time frame is changing. The power of nation states is also changing into other alternatives. I don't want to go into what those alternatives are. And Israel is one of those, like every all those other states. It is not eternal, it is not forever, and this is not particularly Jewish. It happens to be the Zionist response to a particular political problem of the 19th or 20th century. So it's 53 years old, and it's constantly changing, 58 years old. So it's constantly changing. So there's one thing to talk about Israel as a political state. There's quite another thing to talk about what does Israel mean? It's v'sarita em Elohim batucha. You are doing battle with, you are wrestling with the divine. Now, that's some enterprise. You're not wrestling with armies, you're not wrestling with governments. You're wrestling with what your own conscience and consciousness is all about. That is some human experience. And we're doing it here. And with all due respect, we're doing a pretty good job with all the craziness and with all of this and with all of that. Israel, most of the time, in most of the situations, is quite a success. In fact, it's a glorious success. In many ways, it makes mistakes. So what? We're human. Well, depends on who gets hurt on the other end. However, it's equally true that in this country, there is no dearth of and no end of people who will get up and scream and rant and rave and say the government is doing it wrong. They should do it this way. And they're not thrown in jail. I mean, this is an amazing situation. You can scream nearly anything you want up to a point. And dissension and even civil disobedience is part and parcel of whatever it is that we do. Sometimes it gets too much for some people sometimes. But that's the price you pay. There are no free lunches. But more than that, you have an incredible amount of freedom if you look at other places on this world. Israel is really doing quite well, amazingly so.
Moshe, what can you tell us about what Israel is doing in the Negev, in Yerucham?
Where?
Yerucham, I'd like to add, is one of a...
That's a loaded question.
is one of a group of cities or towns known as development towns. These are the towns that were built rather hastily in the early 50s.
And are still becoming.
And are still in the process of becoming. And they were built primarily for the new immigrants, the hundreds of thousands of people who showed up at the door, mostly the door bay being Haifa, coming by boat, many from Cyprus, those from Europe, those from North Africa, some by airplane from Yemen and Iraq and so on. And these towns became notoriously non-functional places. And for some reason, my good friend, Dr. Rabbi Moshe Dror, has chosen to live in one of these places, which has an incredible reputation of non-functionality.
He fell in love.
Okay.
The cat's out of the bag.
Okay. Allow me to make two observations, if I may. Number one, the word Yerucham comes from the Hebrew, which is based on the Arabic, or it's the cognate words, it's similar words, of Bir Rahma. This is the town in which Abraham, according to the rabbinic to the biblical tradition, sent out Hagar and Ishmael, and that, if you remember the story, the boy was just about to die, and God miraculously provided a well in which he drank and was saved, and Ishmael became the progenitor of what we now call the entire Arab community. So Yerucham is based on this connectivity between Isaac and Ishmael. In other words, the Jews and the Arabs, the Bedou, who live there. Okay. And it is called the Be'er Rachma, the well of compassion. So the first important thing you've got to remember is before you can do anything else, you need compassion. Compassion for others and compassion for yourself. In other words, you make mistakes, mazel tov, otherwise you'd be dead or psychotic. Now, that's number one. Well, everybody talks about the issue of, well, we should change the desert and make the desert bloom. My question is, why? We assume that the only place that people can live is with greenery. They all came from Europe. They all deal with only those things that will give you food. But the magic of Yerucham is that it is in the desert, and the desert has its own majesty, its own magic, and its own mystery. That's why so many people are attracted to it, including myself. To go out into the desert, you don't see buildings, you don't see people, you see nature in its most raw, powerful, and majestic format. And what do you see? Sand. What is sand? Silica. What are these computers built on? Silica. We talk about Silicon Valley. Okay. So that's the second thing. Why did we go to Yerucham? I was part of a garin, a group of people who were making aliyah. This was in the late 70s and early 80s. We're all Americans. We're all academics. We all came from major cities and major universities and wanted to do something that was Zionist and something that was adventurous. So basically what we did is we looked, what's the exact opposite? So as you mentioned, Yerucham was a development town. There were 42 development towns that the government built. Two were successes, 40 were unsuccessful. The least successful, the most unsuccessful, is Yerucham, and was Yerucham. So we said, that's where we're going to go. So we in fact built a college that lasted for 8 years, of which I was involved with, and that the dean and the president, etc., etc. And then the great magic and mystery. I met a woman who for 25 years, Simcha, I have been living with, it's my wife, fell in love with the place, fell in love with her, and have been living in this small town. And whenever I give these lectures, which I do frequently because I'm part of the Ministry of Education, I always make this spiel, and everybody bursts out laughing, that I come from New York City to Yerucham City. Yerucham City, Yerucham is a small town, maybe 8,000 people, literally in the middle of nowhere, Podunk of Israel. And yet, it's a place of sheer magic. And to be there for 25 years and see its ups and its downs is like the story of life and the story of the Negev and the story of Israel. So, why am I there? Basically because I love it.
I might have asked you this already, but I'd like to ask it again and maybe get another perspective. You talked, and you know a great deal about the ideas of what is being created in the future context or for the future. How do you see Israel's position in this developing universe, new universe of humanity?
It depends in which areas you're talking about. There's the technological areas, there's spiritual areas. Well, just to give you a couple of examples. Israel is a tiny little place. Interesting, there are three sort of major centers in the world that deal with at least the technological developments that are the underpinnings and the backbone of at least a good deal, not all of, but certainly a good deal, of this new technology that's the electronic technology, information technology. One of them is the United States, obviously the leader in the world. Second is Japan, obviously another major leader. India and China, huge development countries. And Israel. Israel's a tiny little place. But per capita, Israel has made some really significant contributions in this area. So number one, when you talk about biotechnology, when you talk about nanotechnology, when you talk about information technology, when you talk about the whole issue of what the Silicon Valley, etc., and its extensions are, two things are happening. One is Israel is becoming a major player. Israelis who are living in other cities or in other countries are becoming an even greater kind of players, and Jews, no matter where they are, always have, I don't know always, but at least for the last couple of hundred years certainly, have been on the forefront of many of these intellectual and scientific areas of growth and development. So that's number one. Number two, Israel is a place of magic, in the sense that no matter what else goes on here, Israel is perceived by itself, and certainly perceived by others, as the home of the spiritual quest of the Western world. It is no small matter that the largest number of people coming to Israel are sponsored by the evangelical Christians. Now, the Zionist movement is becoming more and more an issue, not only how do you save a country, but how do you save the planet? You're really talking about rewriting the story or stories of humanity within this next couple of centuries. For example, we're dealing with three different kinds of approaches. One is you're talking about how do you develop the new logic, the logos. In the book of John in the New Testament, it says, John 1:1, in the beginning was the Word. Well, that's what is translated into English. But in the Greek, logos is how do you organize something? What is the logic? That's where the word comes from. In other words, what is a coherent pattern out of chaos? So all the sciences are part of this kind of logos. And we're now developing, as with the rest of the world, this kind of dimension. We're also dealing with the issue of the mythos. Mythos is a Greek word also, which literally means story. Not just any story, but a significant foundational story. Every culture has its own narrative. Now we use the term narrative. But basically you're talking about the grand story. Jews have a particular story, how the world got to be the way it is, how people got to be the way they are, and how Jews got to be the way they are. Now, we are also developing new myths. This is not just what happened then, it's what's happening now. And I would venture to suggest that people like George Lucas and Star Wars, Roddenberry and Star Trek, The Lord of the Rings, all of these are great cultural mythos traditions which are now being reorganized for the next century. We are rewriting our great stories. Now, that's not such a simple matter, because you have to write it in a way, or write it in a form, that not only you can tell it, but others are going to listen and say, wow, I want to be part of this enterprise. And there are enough really bright people around that are rewriting these stories of mythos. We become, in effect, the hero on the hero's journey into this next millennium. The way you do that is through what we call the memes, the cultural memes. The meme is a brand new word that was developed by Dawkins, and, 50 years ago, something like that. He took the word gene, which is the genetic code, namely the biological code, shifted the first letter from the G to an M, so it becomes your memory. All of us, in order to tell a story, have a historic genetic system, what he called the memory system. So where we get memes from. And there's a whole field now called mimetics. Every time you sing a song, put on a particular kind of clothing, or eat in a certain way, or talk in a certain language, these are examples of memes that create communities for those who are members of it and keep out other people who are not members of it, so that you create boundaries. Everything needs some kind of boundary. If there's no boundary, then there's no coherence. Now, that's one thing. But what we're basically dealing with is, how do you deal with value memes? In other words, not just any memory. And it's not just any kind of a story that you want to tell. We are basically into the issue of, how do you create a world in which there is value systems? And for example, simply to quote one of my favorite guys, is George Lucas. He says, what is Star Wars all about? So after he did Star Wars, he wanted to create a myth, a story, that dealt with only one thing, which was salvation and redemption. That's all it is. It's a story of how the good guys, in the end, win out. And it's a story not just about black and white, I mean, that's pretty easy, but it's how the guy in the white becomes the guy in the black, Darth Vader, where the new young kid on the block, Luke Skywalker, has a whole new weapon. It's not the sword of steel, and it's not the sword of bronze, and it's not the sword of airplanes, it's the sword of light, the sword of knowing, the sword of gnosis, the sword of consciousness. All of these stories and mythic traditions that Lucas used, and that Jackson used when he did The Lord of the Rings, I mean, there's no end to all of this, literally recreates mythic traditions of our culture, whole new ways in which new generations are able to relate to the past generations, the present generations, and an anticipation for the future generations.
I'm going over the same thing time and again.
What do you want to hear?
Yes.
How does all of that relate to Israel and Jewish? Is there a specific relation that you can perceive that relates to Israel and or Jewish?
With that, is Torah our myth?
You keep on pushing me, and I'll tell you, I don't know, the Torah is not myth. The Torah is a story.
Okay.
But you got to remember that there are, 13 million Jews in the world? Mashu, sort of. Well, there are nearly 2 billion Christians, to whom this story is central, germane, and critical, and something like 1.5 billion Muslims, also to whom this is central and germane and critical. Depends who you ask. You're asking different kinds of questions. First of all, for the last couple of 2,000 years or so, the Jewish-Christian tradition has been one thing. You like it, you don't like it, that's not the issue. And you can say that in Europe, the Jews have been persecuted. Okay. But probably many more women have been killed than Jews have been killed. Except until the Shoah. The Shoah is a whole different animal altogether.
The Holocaust.
I mean, the Holocaust is really a unique historic experience. But other than that, many more women were burned at the stake than Jews. I mean, just think of it. In the witch burnings, etc. That's number one. Now, you're talking about a radical shift, not only in Judaism, but in every religious tradition. Now what people are beginning to see is the relationship that is not only common in the past, so you look for those nuggets of commonality and sharedness, but where do I want to go in the future? And in the future, we're talking about not hundreds of years, but just 100 years. You got to remember that your children and your grandchildren, let's put it that way, are in all probability going to live more than 100 years. Which means that when we're talking about this present generation, you're talking already about the 22nd century. And if you talk now about, just think of how the world has changed within the past 100 years, just think of how the world is going to change even far greater in the next 100 years within your lifetime. That's the point. Or the lifetime of your children. I'm not talking about science fiction. I'm talking about science fact. Just open the window and look. That's number one. So, yes, there are different strains. Yes, everybody comes out of their own traditions, good, bad, and different, whatever. And within each of these, you have people who want to close the box and close the window and maintain what they see as the glorious old days or this sacralization of the past and nostalgia, really, not what was, but the nostalgia of the past. Others who say, look, whatever was, there's nothing you're going to do about it. The only place you're going to live is in the future. So how can you do what you need to do to be able to get the best of each of these traditions, to be able not to live in survival mode, which is it is a big deal, but in thrival mode, to thrive. We can do this. We have energies that we never, ever had before.
So tell me, how do we do this? How is it possible when we see at least a certain segment of the Muslim world that sees itself under threat and under siege, how do we, and has the potential capability of destroying the world as we know it, how is it possible to avoid it, and how do we get to that point where they don't no longer feel threatened?
Okay, each tradition, and particularly Islam in its glory days, in the Middle Ages, was the cultural capital, at least of the Mediterranean world, anyway, inside of China and India. So it is built into the system. The question is, how do the people within their own communities get their own voices to share this kind of perception? You're right. How do you do this? I don't know. If I know, I'd have a Nobel Prize tomorrow morning. The issue is, though, we only focus on a very small community and a very narrow band of what is in a particular culture. All I'm suggesting is that that's there, you can't ignore it, but that's not all that's there. And there are enough people of goodwill for two reasons. First of all, they don't want to die either. The second thing is that a lot of us see that unless we somehow or other join together, we're going to really create a mess. Now, it's one thing to create a mess. That's okay. You can always sort of clean up a mess. But you can't clean up a dead planet. That's a whole different animal. So, are you talking about a world of brinkmanship? Well, just think of what happened nearly 30 years ago with Khrushchev and Kennedy. We got to a certain point and then they stopped. They said, no, we can't do it. Whether that will happen again, I can't tell you. I don't know. All that we do know is that there are enough people around who have enough sense and enough courage to be able to get up in public places, etc., etc., and say, you want to play, boys, play with your toys, da-da-da-da-da-da, up to a point. That's one response. The other thing is that my guess is that we are now just in the early stages of a major evolution, in a spirit of consciousness of what it means to be human, that that expands each of the traditions and creates new traditions. If the issue is you're talking about individuals and networked individuals, then new religious traditions grow up constantly. They grow up, they die, they change, they transform. Welcome to being alive. So the issue that these classical systems won't be the same way that they were, thanks God, why should they? Everything changes. That's the only guarantee that there is. More than that, there is this built-in, I think. Depends on what you mean by built-in. But at least inherent, and it also depends on what you mean by that. Part of being human is, in some way, being part of the spiritual quest. It didn't start with Abraham. He wasn't the only one. But it certainly was one of the grand stories of the Western world, of which I am a member. Why am I in Yucatan? You say, what is that Jewish? Well, how come I left New York, left Chicago, left Geneva, came to Israel? Because I live in the same tracks that Abraham lived in. That's why. And I will never, ever forget, never. The first year I came here in Israel, 1981, it was 2 days before Rosh Hashanah. And if you know that on the days of on Rosh Hashanah, you read the story of the Akedah, the binding of Isaac, and you read the story of Hagar and Ishmael. And I remember going out to the traditional place, whether it was historically, archaeologically, nice, but it doesn't really matter, where Abraham was supposed to have built that well. I took my shoes off, and I just walked around, and I felt, from I don't know how many layers, you're talking about 4,000 years of sand and of earth, that same kind of narrative energy that drew me here and drew you here, and you, we're all Americans sitting here in Tel Aviv. Why are we doing it? So the question is, what is Israel all about? If we wouldn't be here, the question wouldn't be, so we're trying to figure out, why are we here? We're here because we're here, because it's important to us. And it's important to enough other people that whatever it is, they left wherever they are. And if they don't want to be here and want to stay where they are, they should enjoy. Not everybody should do what I do, so what? More than that, in a sense, you're really talking about an adventure. An adventure always has surprises. An adventure always is a big game. And in a way, history is in effect an adventure. And I'm really honored to be part of that adventure.
Thank you so much, Moshe.
My pleasure.
We've been listening to Dr. Rabbi Moshe Dror. And if anybody has any comments or any questions they'd like to address to him, you can get him at the radio at israelscene.com. And we look forward to more conversations and discussions with him. For now, this is Steve.
And Yoram.
And Moshe.
Yeah.
Thank you, guys.
My pleasure. Thank you.